Okay, the only man that comes on the show that gets a wardrobe change, Billy Lucci, Tex Eggs. What's up, man?
I'm good. We had to change out the black hat. It was like covering my whole face. I felt like I got to do something with this lighting in here. We can't get it right. We got all these like big lights, and I feel like they're just they're worse than they're doing me worse than they are better. So hat change. I also thought it was like a whole shirt change. I've got them in the car. I've got two other outfits, so maybe mid segment we'll do a switch up.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll send Cousin Shane down there. He's an expert when it comes to all technical issues, lighting. He'll get you guys set up down there at Tex Eggs.
Problem is, you guys would have to actually come to College Station, which you have yet to do. So
we're coming this year, for sure, Tennessee.
Okay, yeah, you need to do that, because y'all's asses can't stay away from Norman or Columbia, it feels like, but God forbid. Yeah, Tennessee would be a great one. That last time they were here was an epic game as well.
Yeah, and who knows? It could be a playoff eliminator once again for both teams next season. So it is nice to visit a team that actually makes the playoffs. So let's start there with A&M. They went to the playoff last season. Obviously, it didn't go as you wanted, but the fact that Miami advanced so far and we found out how good they are, did that take any of the sting off of it, or is it still just as tough?
It probably adds to the sting, in my opinion. And you know, you'll get people from other fan bases calling that some kind of like, well, I don't know which one would qualify as a moral victory, if it took the sting off or if it added to it. But to me, it added to it, not because like, it's not as simple as going, oh, A&M would have been Miami. They would have beat Ohio State. They would have gone on and beaten Ole Miss and gone and played for the national championship. I mean, maybe. There's a lot of teams, not a lot, but there's probably a couple teams in that playoff field that felt that way. They played Miami too, and it was a weird day in terms of weather. I think it affected, you know, both teams. It's a weird day. Miami missed three field goals. A&M, I think it really hurt their passing game, which I think they would have thrown it a lot more than Miami would have. They would have leaned on that ground game and that O-line. You played them to a tie game through, what, 58 and a half minutes? And then you're down first and goal at the five-yard line to go to overtime. That wasn't 2001 Miami. That wasn't mid-90s or late 90s Miami. That wasn't Nick Saban, Alabama. They played for the national title. That was the precursor that no one realized at the time to them playing as good a football as anyone in college football is playing just south of Indiana. I mean, they gave Indiana all they wanted. So it just tells me that A&M ran into a really tough team. At the time, one of the two best teams in the country. And they fell just short. It tells me that with a different draw, we might have been having a different conversation with a different finish there at the end if they get those 5 yards. Who knows what we're talking about? I went to the Miami-Ohio State game. I watched that. Ohio State looked like I thought they would look. I didn't trust their offense. Do I think A&M would have beaten Ohio State? I think Ohio State wins more games out of 10 for sure between the two teams. But on that night in Dallas, in a Cotton Bowl with all the A&M fans, I think that would have been a hell of a game. I don't think Ohio State was – I didn't think when that playoff draw came out, I thought Miami would give them a problem. I think A&M would have. I think Ohio State had some flaws this past year. They were as good as anyone, but they weren't nearly as good as they were the year before. I said that all year. So there was an opportunity there for A&M. So I think it gets you – more pissed because you saw what Miami did. And credit Miami, they did it. A&M didn't do it. A&M didn't win the game head-to-head on their home field. And everything else after that for the Aggies would have been a hypothetical. So you credit Miami for doing it, but I think it probably frustrates you more because you don't get those chances often. Even if A&M ends up being a better team moving forward, playoff runs are hard. They depend on who you're playing. Just like what we just talked about, what time of year you run into an opponent. There's the path through the SEC to get there. I mean, look, let's be honest. Texas and Vanderbilt were damn good teams last year. They didn't get in. It's hard to get in, you know. So it, when you have the opportunity and you fail to take advantage of it, I think it's more it stings more than you feel good about it. I always felt like this team was a really good team. Felt like it walking off the field. I say it like I was on the field playing, but I was literally on the side, like walking off the field. I felt that way after the Miami game. I knew it after the Texas game. You know, none of that changed the fact that I think A&M was a really damn good team last year, a top 10 team. It's just you wonder how far you could have gone had you earned the chance to keep playing.
I'm glad you said that, Billy, that, you know, again, this is, you know, perhaps a missed opportunity, but I think it's safe to say that A&M exceeded all expectations last year, going 11-1. I don't know anybody that predicted that, but is that kind of the expectation now under Elko? Where not 11-1 every year, but 10-2. I mean, this is kind of what the A&M program has always been hyped up to be. You know, one of the most dominant teams. They got all the resources. They should be winning at a high level. Is that the expectation now under Mike Elko to basically annually compete for a playoff spot?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I think they should annually compete for a playoff spot. I think they should be a – you got to think about what they did. You know, Penn State had tremendous interest in – I think Elko was the guy they wanted from the outset. What A&M did to keep Mike Elko – what A&M's doing in terms of NIL. And I want it to be said too, like, I don't know, certain coaches do a certain amount in terms of how hard they're willing to work and push on the NIL front. I don't think there's a coach in college football that does more than Mike Elko. I mean, I know there are ones that can do as much. I understand that. And there are, I don't know who they are, but I do know what Mike Elko does is like above and beyond, whether that's meeting with donors around the state and around the country, whether that's pushing internally to get things the way they need to be. And he is just NIL and you know, the whatever you want to call it, salary cap, and these things are things that he's put a lot of work into to get A&M in that upper echelon and to keep them there. And so when you add that and you add, you know, how much A&M's committed to him and are continuing to do things with facilities. People say that doesn't matter anymore. It does, and they still are. And then you look at his first, like, somebody asked me the other day, Mike, they're like, oh, you know, what about Elko? Where's the portal class rank? Did we get anybody good in the portal? And what about the recruiting class? I go, man, they're fine. They're both top 10. And Mike Elko's about to have maybe a half dozen portal players drafted. I think in two classes here, he might have seven portal guys drafted. Last year when he inherited it, he inherited two NFL draft picks, Shamar Stewart and Shamar Turner. They added Nick Scorton in the portal. They only had three guys at the combine, three guys drafted. This year they lead the country with 13 combine athletes, and they're going to have maybe 10 drafted. And someone tried to say, oh, what did they accomplish with all that? That's kind of, well, they went to the playoffs for the first time in school history. Like you said, they were picked to go 8-4, 7-5, right? They went 11-1. That's what they accomplished. Like, what do you mean, what did they accomplish? Like, and so, yeah, I think it's very fair, Mike, to elevate the expectation. I think it's fair because of what everyone has sunk into this thing staying there. I think it's fair for Mike Elko and his staff deserve the benefit of the doubt. I mean, they deserve the benefit of the doubt in terms of evaluation, how they attack the portal, player development, and on-field results. Because when you gave him a full offseason to construct his team, which was last year's team, they won 11 of 12 regular season games, went to a college football playoff. Lost that game to the national runner-up on basically the final snap of the game. That was a really damn good team. So that's your evidence. That's your body of work. That's what you have to go off of. So I think you absolutely give them the benefit of the doubt, but I also think you do raise expectations because that's You just did it. You know, you don't want to step back. And I'm not saying, Mike, that they won't step back. But I'm just saying, like, there's going to be years. But I think that's the standard moving forward now, is be a top five team in the SEC. For lack of cut through all the other stuff, be a top five program in the SEC, and you'll be in more playoffs than you're not. And you'll start making those runs as well when you get, you know, everything right.
When you talk about that critical play against Miami at the end of the game, interception in the end zone, it ends the game is what it did. But where do you put your confidence level in Marcel Reed going into the offseason? Because we all know the quarterbacks get too much credit and too much blame. And I feel like Marcel doesn't get any credit for winning 11 games, but at least nationally it's, well, you know, Texas second half was not good. That Miami playoff game, you know, he's a fraud, all this, that, and the other. I'm not saying he's a fraud, but my confidence is slightly shaken in him. But where's your confidence level in Marcel Reed being that guy? Because I think he's going to have to be even better if A&M's going to make the playoff.
I do too. I think the two biggest individual like figures for me with A&M to get back I don't know if I want to call it a tougher schedule, because you're replacing Notre Dame on the road with Arizona State at home. So I know you're doing an extra conference game, and that SEC schedule looks a lot tougher, but you're taking off Notre Dame. I don't know how ASU is going to be minus Levitt and Tyson and their top offensive tackle who transferred. Like, Raylique Brown is going to be at Texas. I think it's still a tougher schedule, though, just the number of games that. But look, man, we sat here last year and everyone told me how tough Florida was going to be, how tough Auburn was going to be, how tough South Carolina was going to be, how tough LSU and their $19 million defense was going to be, and Nussmeier and Sellers and Lagway. So everyone told me all that, right? Everyone told me that A&M couldn't go win at Notre Dame. And then at the end of the season, what everybody said was they had an easy path to get there. So I'll certainly say it was easier than it looked going into the season, without question. A&M had a little to do with that by beating all those teams too. But as I look at it this year, man, I have a hard time envisioning that schedule not being really difficult. I think OU, Alabama, Texas, you're on the road at LSU and Missouri again. I mean, you've got Tennessee coming to Kyle Field. So it is a tough draw. I think most fan bases would say that right now about their schedules with nine. So Marcel, I'm with you. Like, he had 10 turnovers in their last five, like, truly meaningful games. You know, I throw out Samford, you know, and one of them was a win against LSU where he played his ass off, but he had 2 turnovers, 10 turnovers in those five games. That's not going to cut it. And I think if you go look at some of those plays, a lot of them are, several of them were like in the red zone, kind of not seeing it right. Several of them were somebody missed a block and he had somebody bearing down on him. And he's just got, I think it's like that Miami play. If you go back and watch it, the right guard completely whiffs and step into that throw and like bite down on that mouthpiece and just throw it, you know? And the same thing against Texas there at the end, he has Craver open for a touchdown if he times it up and throws it, but the left guard gets whipped on that play and he throws it, you know, kind of falling away. And those are just things that I think he's going to watch a tape and go, I got to get better at that, because instead of interceptions, those are touchdowns. And we go to OT. I do think, by the way, A&M was going to go for 2 against Miami. I do think that, which would have been pretty phenomenal in terms of theater and tension, right? But against Texas, you know, that throw cuts it to 27-24 with 3-plus minutes left in the game. Totally different deal. So he has to eliminate that. But I don't think, and I've had this, you know, we had a massive debate on our show with our good friend Amanda Atwell. We had this Arch Manning, Marcel Reed, and we did the stat comparison. I go, I get this and this. I get that Marcel's turnovers towards the end of the year. So I understand where Arch is rated going into next year, whereas you and I – both thought it was way overrated and way premature a year ago. I agree that shouldn't be the case this year. He's earned a lot of preseason buzz and credit. He should be on those lists. But if you look, it's still a full year's worth of work. And if you tell me, well, Arch Manning was bad early in the year because his O-line was bad, I would say go back and watch A&M versus South Carolina, where he ended up having an amazing stat line after the brutal first half. But go back and watch South Carolina, Texas, and Miami, and I would tell you, and maybe it had to do with Dylan Stewart, Colin Simmons, and Bain and Mesidor, probably four of the five best pass rushers in college football, but the running game went away, and the protection of Marcel went away. And I think that had as much to do, Mike, with his struggles as he did. He was all of a sudden under quite a bit of pressure and duress, and it affected him. Now, he's going to have to let it affect him less, right? So I think the keys to this whole team next year, the whole season, it's number 10, it's Holman Wiggins, first-time OC. Elko could have hired outside, and he looked at some people. He went in-house. Those two, but I'll go back to what I just said. It doesn't matter what those two do. The biggest key to this Texas A&M football season and getting back and being a playoff contender, how did they do in terms of the portal additions on the O-line? Because they went and got four SEC veterans to replace four departing starters. So how well did they evaluate that? If they did a good job, this O-line could be as good or better this year.
Well, Billy, it's like you're literally looking at my notes here. I wanted to ask you, let's...
And they passed on the guy that you have as the number one SEC portal O-lineman that's at South Carolina
they,
now.
They passed on Peak?
That at least, yes, absolutely. That at least tells you how they feel about the guys they took instead. Yeah. So, TBD, I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I know his resume, and I think he's really good. So, we'll see.
So let me ask you first about Holman Wiggins. You just referenced him. Mm-hmm. Because I've gotten away from, I think it's foolish to just sit here and be like, oh, that's a good hire. This is a bad hire. I don't think we should do that about anybody. It's just an opinion and it means nothing. I think the way to evaluate these is to look at them as like risk propositions. And for A&M, who, if you look at the advanced numbers on offense, they had their best season since the COVID season. I don't really count the COVID season because it was so wacky, but you have to go even further back to, I think it was year two, Kevin Sumlin. So it's been a long time since A&M was that good on offense as they were last year. You lose the play caller, and at A&M, we've already talked about it, they got all the resources in the world. You can imagine they could probably get their hand-picked offensive coordinator. They stay in-house, name a guy that, to my knowledge, has not called plays in college football. That seems risky, but why do they do that, and what's your thoughts on that?
I think, well, my thoughts are, we'll see. You know, my thoughts are I trust Elko until he gives me reason not to trust him, like in terms of like the results. I trust that he's going to get the results because all I've seen both at Duke and here is him getting the results. And yeah, I mean, he's got to know what a significant, I don't think he views it as a roll of the dice. I think he understands like if you haven't called plays outside of a spring game or two, a couple of spring games, you are rolling the dice by definition because you really don't know how it's going to come out. Maybe they're weighted dice in his mind. Maybe he's like, no, clearly he believes that continuity. Holman Wiggins was ready to be an OC. Let's be clear about that because there's a reason Elko brought in Coach Perry from the Houston. You know, he'd been, I think he was at Temple at the time, but he was a long time with the Houston Texans. He brought him in because Elko loves to have in-house promotions, and if Holman Wiggins was going to leave, it was to probably become an OC somewhere else. And then, obviously, when Colin Klein left, that opened up. And I talked to Elko throughout that. And much earlier than the public knew, and if you could go back and fact-check me on this, because I mentioned it the day Colin Klein, when it came out, he was leaving, because he was actually going to take South Florida. And then he found out that Klieman was leaving K-State, and that changed like literally the night before signing day. It was going to be South Florida. He had taken, essentially agreed to that job. And I mentioned the day I broke like the Kansas State stuff, I mentioned Holman Wiggins is looking like a likely replacement here. And now it took a few weeks before that was already, in my opinion, kind of done. The search was prior to anyone knowing about the Colin Klein news. So Elko did talk to people. I know, the name Buster Faulkner has come up elsewhere, and that is true. He was one of the people that was under consideration. He's now at Florida, Georgia Tech. Elko chose to go the route he went, and he knew, like you said, the money was there to go out and hire and explore, and he did that, and he kept coming back to, I believe in Holman Wiggins, and I believe in what we're doing offensively. This is not a defensive head coach that has no thoughts on the offense and just goes and, let's say hire like a Kendall Briles at South Carolina. He's got a resume, right? I know his resume. You know it. You could just do that, plug him in there, and then say, okay, well, we're going to run his off. That wasn't what he was comfortable with. That wasn't what he believed in. What he believed in was, like you said, the offense that they had on the field this past year. And clearly he thinks Wiggins can call plays and run the offense. And I think also, Mike, the whole operation, that's Adam Cushing, that's Trooper Taylor, that's the other guy, that's Perry on the staff who I talked about, that's everybody on the offensive staff. I think he just loved the room. But, again, if you want to rank Holman really low on the OC list, there's nothing he's given you to rank him higher. Mike Elko would be the one person that would say differently. And again, that's TBD. So, I mean, if that O-line's right, they should have plenty of weapons. I would say go look at the wide receiving core, the pass catchers he's going to be thrown to this year. There's a lot there. And I think from talking to the players, I had Craver in here this past week. We had Ashton Bethel-Roman in here. I think they think there's going to be even more of kind of an aerial attack this year, maybe with a little more, a little more wide open even than it was.
Well, hey, you already talked about that offensive line a little bit. Confidence level that they could get that situated because, this is kind of a problem all across college football where It's not unique to A&M where it's like you got to replace an entire unit and you got to do it via the portal. There's SEC teams that have replaced the entire secondary or the receiving core or on and on and on. But that's also a risky proposition, right? Because if you misevaluate a guy or two, you could be in real trouble up there.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think what I like about A&M on the O-line and the D-line for that matter, they have a nice combination of the Aggies kept their young linemen that are in year two or three that got a lot of attention from elsewhere. Guys like Robert Borden, like Blake Ivey, like Lamont Rogers, who was a five-star last year, Tyler Thomas, Nelson McGuire. These are all guys that got a lot of attention from other schools, and they kept all of them. Somebody out of that group's going to start. It's not just like, hey, these are your four portal. Here's your one returning starter. There's your starting five. I don't think it's ever going to be that clean. Like somebody's going to develop over there and push their way in. There's still a thing called competition. But I think if you look at a team like Texas last year, Steve Sarkisian and Flood screwed up. And their fans know it and have been vocal about this. It's not me going for a clip for everybody to have their fun with here, and which – you and I are cool with that too, which is what I think people still have yet to figure out or understand. We're okay with it. Clip us, do whatever you want. We're going to speak our mind. But I'm saying what their own fans have said since about September last year, which I was saying in August and July and June. They relied almost exclusively on the players they had on campus that were unproven in SEC games. That is a failing. Your risk for failure is way too high when you have quarterbacks like Marcel Reed, like Arch Manning, like, Trinidad Chambliss, John Mateer, Lagway, whoever that may be, Sellers. That's a great example. If you can't block for your talented quarterback, why even have a talented quarterback? And that's what Texas struggled with. And I think other teams too. And I think the reality is Elko realized it. Sarkisian realized it. If you look at what he did in the portal on the O-line this year, you've got to have that mix. I don't think you can rely exclusively on one or the other, but you better go portal and say, look, at worst, this is what we've got. And we've got veterans that have played and we can watch tape. So like Wilkin Formby, Tyree Adams, Cohen Eccles, Baugh at South Carolina, you can pop in SEC tape of these guys and watch them play against SEC opposition. And forget about what any of the fan bases say. I know LSU and Alabama's O-lines were were bad last year and held them back. But if you watch, these coaches are watching tape of those guys I mentioned block against SEC opponents. They can compare it directly to what their NFL outgoing O-lineman did against the same opponent. So it does seem like a formula that it's less risk, lower risk. And then again, you've got those young guys that haven't played a lot that if one of them rises up. So I love what they did on both lines of scrimmage in terms of they've got a mix of incumbents and newcomers and then let it kind of sort itself out. And more than anything, I love two SEC additions, Mike. Okay, guys you're familiar with. Isaiah Horton at receiver. And on the other side of the ball, Ricky Gibson from Tennessee. If you're going to give me Horton with Mario Craver, Ashton Bethel-Roman, and I'm just here to tell you there's several young names in this receiving core that are going to be really good like this year. Guys like Jerome Miles, Aaron Gregory, there's several. But you go and look on the other side of the ball and you're going to tell me you're going to go Ricky Gibson and Dez Ricks potentially as your starting corners. Those two additions from Tennessee and Alabama, I feel like are going to be major, major impact guys for the Aggies this season.
Yeah, damn it, Ricky Gibson. He should have stayed, really, but Billy, I mean, I think...
I don't know the backstory.
Well, they fired the position coach. I think he just didn't want to play in a new defense, but he is a hell of a corner. I'll give you that. Hey, I know you saw this because I saw you react to it on social media. So my early prediction for A&M, I swear this is not me trolling, was 8-4. And I believe the word you used was pretty chalky, but I said at LSU, at Bama, I think, and then at Oklahoma and Texas were my projected losses for A&M. So I've picked them to beat Texas every year. I'm not picking them to beat Texas again until they actually do it. So what's your thoughts on that 8-4 and feel free to roast me if you think that's a bad take.
I don't think that's roast worthy. I think if you look at what you just did, and then I would ask you, what's the line between 8-4 and 10-2? You know, like, do you think A&M's going to go into Baton Rouge and get run out of the stadium by Sam Levitt and Kiffin and company? Do you think they've got no chance to go win at Alabama? That maybe it's Alabama that's 8-4 next year. You know, do you say? And I'll go the flip side, like. You got them beaten, winning at South Carolina over Sellers and that group. You Dylan Stewart and company. You've got them going and beating Tennessee at home. Like there's games in there that you got them. You got them beating Missouri in Columbia. So I when I said chalky, I meant it. Like okay, Texas is going to be ranked higher. We know that. I think when these preseason rankings come out, you'll see A&M ranked kind of right there in the same area, probably within seven spots in the rankings, you're going to see Alabama, LSU, A&M, OU. I think I would bet money on that. So you basically pick them to win a couple toss-ups and lose like three toss-ups. So I don't think that's an outlandish prediction because again, like I said, I think the line between 8-4 and 10-2 is going to be a couple games like Miami, a couple games like Notre Dame, where which way are they going to go at the end? So I wouldn't argue with somebody. I would disagree. I think A&M will be more than 9-10. But I wouldn't say it's any kind of crazy prediction. Just like I think anyone that would say A&M going 10-2 and getting back in the playoffs, if someone said that's a silly prediction, I think they're out of line for thinking that too. I think this is a team. I think that's their range. It's like that 8-4, 10-2.
Yeah, and while I was,
they need to get above 8-4. By the way, they need to figure out because, yeah, like to me, 9. If you got to 9, Mike. And I want to see them do better than that. But I know that's – we talked about the standard a minute ago. 9 either means you're 8-3 and then you beat Texas at Kyle Field to end the regular season, or it means you're 9-2 and you're playing again in the final game of the season to go to the college football playoff. Again, I don't think that would be like some kind of noteworthy step back. I think that would still continue – program momentum in the right direction. Like you said, a true playoff contender, not like, oh, if they had this, that's a true playoff contender. And so I think 9 is kind of my cutoff to where I'd say they've sustained and continue the momentum that they grabbed a hold of last year. 10. And I think Mike Elko has this thing rolling towards an eventual championship. If they were to go to playoffs back-to-back years, because I do think this is as close to like it's a reloading year, not a rebuilding, but they're replacing a lot. So if they can get back replacing that much, then that tells me that they did a masterful job in the portal and with player development.
Yeah, I don't know if you've actually sat down and looked at all the schedules and tried to do this yourself, but one thing that really struck me with a 9-game SEC schedule, it's very hard to path a 10-win season for most of these. I only have 3 teams winning 10 games. And it's just, I don't know if fans are.
Who are they?
I got Georgia. I got Oklahoma and Texas.
Is Oklahoma's schedule kind of easy, or are we back on the Oklahoma Sooner?
It's not too friendly. I mean, it's at Michigan. They should win that. At Georgia, that's going to be brutal. They can't beat Texas either. At Florida, Ole Miss. I think Ole Miss is going to be really good. A&M.
They're at Ole Miss, right? Or they
got Ole Miss at home.
Oh, they got back to back with them. Mm-hmm. I think that's a perfect. I mean, that's a tough schedule. There's nothing easy about that. OU's an interesting one. I'm still not going to be sold. Again, like, my thing is this. If you have questions about – I'm one that still has questions about Arch Manning. Like, I still think – everyone can talk about Marcel's accuracy. I still think he needs to become a much more accurate passer week in and week out. I mean, even against A&M, I would challenge anyone to go back and watch that game and say, where were the great throws in that game? I think he did it, and I credit him for this. He did it off like as much over with his legs and toughness, like mental toughness, just hanging in when they scored 3 points in the first half and not letting it get in his head. I thought he showed a lot of maturity and toughness more so than I saw an elite passer. Maybe he doesn't have to be, but I'm still he's still got stuff to prove. I think Sam Leavitt, like if we're nitpicking Marcel Reed, what are we doing with Sam Leavitt? And I know Kiffin, is a great quarterback developer, but then I also go and look at Mateer. And if we're going to do this thing with Mateer, and I could see a world where he ends up living up to what everyone thought entering last year. But if we're going to do this thing again with him, I think you have to hold him to kind of that same microscope that you're going to put Marcel Reed under. And I think you have to do that with a lot of these quarterbacks because unlike Arch, I don't think Mateer necessarily hit the offseason on some kind of upswing, and everyone's going to talk about this hand injury. I think he was playing healthy down the stretch. I'm not buying the whole thing. And by the way, Mike, I didn't think he looked great prior to the hand injury. He should have thrown 3 picks against Michigan. He didn't look great against Auburn in that game. So I like him. I still think he has a lot to prove as well. I love the OU like defense and mindset and culture under Venables. I think that's such a tough game for A&M this year going up there. And I think Aggie fans are going to see like Alabama, which again, not to say that's anything but difficult, but I think if I'm ranking road tough games this year, I'm going OU one, and then I'm debating between LSU and Bama. But I think Oklahoma in Norman the week before the Aggies play Texas, you mentioned a potential playoff elimination game. A&M might play three in a row. They go, what, Tennessee? Am I right? Tennessee.
Oklahoma.
OU, Texas. Yeah. Is that their last three? Ain't no Samford in there this year. That's a brutal closing stretch right there. And then you can go back to at South Carolina and at Bama prior to that. It's insane. But those last three, that might determine, right? Like the Aggies might have to go 2-1 in those three to get to the playoffs. I mean, so you better be a really good football team. But I'm with you, man. You go through and it's hard. So you pick OU to go 10-2. And I bet you can pick three games there where you're like, yeah, I could see that go either way, that you have them winning, right?
Yeah, without a doubt.
And Texas, to me, like, their fans got all up in arms. Something I said yesterday, I'm like, you know, if they lose to Ohio State, who they're playing, but Bama just can't or hasn't done it yet, but they're talking of canceling them. I'm fine with I understand why Bama's canceling or will maybe cancel that series. We're to this point where it does no good, right? And maybe Texas was the straw that broke the camel's back, because had they not played Ohio State, they're probably in the playoffs at 10-2, right? Everybody can say, well, you shouldn't have lost to Florida, and I agree. But had they played a Wake Forest or somebody, they're 10-2. Had they played Illinois or Purdue out of the Big Ten, they're 10-2 and in the playoffs, even with that Florida loss. So I'm fine with Bama canceling it. I hate that that's where college football is going. I would love to see A&M continue to play games like Miami home and home, Notre Dame home and home. I think a lot of Texas fans would love to continue seeing them play Ohio State, Michigan. But they're probably, my bet would be they'll probably cancel the Notre Dame series. Somebody pointed out to me they're in the middle of the Ohio State, Michigan series, right? If they lose to Ohio State next year, 14-7, like they did last year, 21-20, and they go 7-2 in the SEC, and somebody goes, what are the two losses in the SEC? I go, I could give you five games that if they lose two of them, I might could give you six. I'm not saying they will lose, but like, look at those games and guarantee me that Texas could be the eighth best team in the country and they could go 7-2. You could be the fifth best team in the country and go 7-2 in those nine. So does that leave them out of the playoffs? I mean, it certainly could. So my point of saying that was not to actually bash them. I was saying it's weird that as all this is changing, teams like Texas and some others are still stuck right in the middle, in the heart of these high-profile home and homes that don't necessarily do you any good, unless you win.
Right. Well, hey, last thing for you, Billy. Really appreciate your time. Now, you may have kind of already answered this, but kind of two-parter. Are you mentally prepared for Texas preseason number one, arch Heisman favorite? And are they prepared to run it back and do it 2 years in a row? Because it didn't work out so well last time.
You know, here's the thing. You know this. I've gotten my ass handed to me almost weekly on this show. So I'm on not this show, but on the Moving Goalposts podcast. I clearly bit off more than I can chew with this whole concept of, like, Amanda and I doing the podcast together, because you know me, I just roll in here and do this. I don't go in the debate realm, and I don't come armed with stats and research, and I probably should, because it's been a rough experience. But I'll say this:
she comes with the burn book. She does. You know,
well, it used to be just the old tweets and burn book. Now she's like it's like, you know, these movies where they're like, well, they've evolved, the virus has evolved, or the alien. And now it's like all this statistical research and football stuff and the, you know, so, but it doesn't change the fact that they were preseason number one last year, and they can say all they want about beating OU and A&M. The Sooners and Aggies got to the playoff. Texas did not. Not only did they not, they will try to argue that they had, that the seasons were comparable and that they're the same. They're not even close, because one team was picked 8-4 and went 11-2 and into the playoff. The other team was preseason number one and didn't even reach the field. They did not, they didn't even finish, you know, they didn't reach the playoff field. The 12-team playoff, five SEC teams made it. They were not one, was it five or was it four? They were
five.
There were five of them. They were not one of them. They were no better than sixth of a 16-team league. In no world was their season better than A&M's or Oklahoma's. So with that said, I thought they should have been like a preseason top five last year. I thought one was too much. They lost too much. I thought it was too much to put on Arch behind a rebuilt offensive line. I was right about all of that. If you want to rank them up there this year, I would, and you want to call Arch a top five Heisman contender going into this season, I'm okay with that now. Because the way their season ended and the way his season ended, that's fine. Like, I do think one would be overrated a little. I think they should be a top five preseason team. I think anyone picking the SEC next year, it should be, I'd have no qualms with seeing Georgia and Texas picked to be in Atlanta. But I just think, as we learned last year, and this is not a knock on them, that margin between 1, 2, 3 and the top half of the league is as small as it's ever been. Like 1v8, 2v7, 3. Like, it is so unpredictable. And if you took the whatever the preseason standings are and you did an Elite Eight to start the college football season, and it was 1-8, 2-7, 3-6, you know, just like that, that would be the most unpredictable tournament. It would be like March Madness. You would have no idea who's going to win, because I think that gap is as narrow as it's ever been. So that's not just for Texas. That's for Georgia, and that's for everyone. Everyone's going to have a fight to get into that playoff. But I do think if you look at what's coming back, I think Texas, I would have much less pushback this year than I did last year. I think on paper and with how they finished the season, I think they actually look more like that type of team than they did a season ago. I think they got four potential first-round draft picks, first-team All-American types, you know, including Cam Coleman out of the portal. I think they got more explosive in the backfield. I think their O-line, while I still think it's going to be the deciding factor for them, I think they look far better at that position than they did going into last year. So I'm good with it. I'm just telling them, if you're going to do a whole offseason of this again, I've got way more receipts than I think their fan base realized that I was just dead ass on right about. I joke, the team I missed the most on this year was A&M, because I picked them 9-3. They went 11-1. So I did pick them in the playoffs at 9-3, which, you know, that's kind of what Texas did, and they didn't get in. But I don't know. Maybe a 9-3 team gets in this year with the 9-game conference schedule. But again, like, I would just say this, wherever you're ranked, whatever the hype is, whether that's the Aggies, the Georgia Bulldogs, LSU, A&M, whatever, man, I think every fan in this conference better come to the realization that this 9-game SEC schedule is, it's going to be a bear. And I hope Greg Sankey got it right in terms of this, these dumbasses on the committee, including, I think please don't have someone like Juracek up there next year. Please don't. Like, put competent people on this committee, because the SEC, by going to 9, and with the Big Ten going, see, now you're finally at 9. Anyone that really understands knows that that's a different 9. And I know the Big Ten is improving and they're coming up, and they, I think they were the best conference last year. But to act like a 9-game SEC schedule is the same as a 9-game Big Ten, I still think that is not understanding both leagues. I really do. And I think if you ask anyone in coaching or anyone in the NFL, I think they would tell you, like, they know the truth. Like, coaches that have been in both conferences, and it's still not the same. So to go to 9, man, if they don't change kind of the way they like, if you put a 2-loss BYU in ahead of a 3-loss, you know, Alabama, or you put a 2-loss Texas Tech, who, if you go look at their schedule, Mike, just look at it. And if you put a 2-loss Tech in ahead of a 3-loss Georgia, then you're doing it wrong. And the last couple years, I promise you, they would have done it wrong. So if they don't fix it, then it was a really bad chess move by Sankey and the SEC. But I don't think Sankey makes many bad moves and big picture decisions. So I do think you'll see that be factored in this year.
Well, Billy, I think you're maturing. I gave you an opportunity to troll the Longhorns. Instead, I think you're going to make some friends.
Listen, let me say something. I'm not scared to troll them. You go look, but I'm being honest. I'm being honest. Like, I will troll them. I'll probably troll them. We're doing this on a Friday. I'll probably do it today. But just being honest, like, Mike, I was right last year. I took all kinds of shit. I was right about Texas, about LSU. I was right. And I'm probably going to be right this year, too. We can keep that scoreboard of it. But anyway, I just think this year it's a little more reasonable and understandable. And I will give, I don't know if I'm giving credit when we're talking about preseason, right? But I will say, like, I'll be within the realms of reality, let's say. I won't let my trolling or my bias let me sit here and not say what I think is true. Contrary to what people think.
Old Honest Abe, let them know how to follow you and how to check out all the fine work you guys do over at TexEggs.
You can follow me just at Billy Lucci on any of the social media platforms, and TexEggs as well, at TexEggs. And then our site, obviously, is TexEggs. I go back to the, used to say, www.texeggs.com. That was, took me like 5 years deep into the, nobody says the www, but that's how long we've been doing it. And I think we're doing a better job than ever with our content and what we're adding. And we got a ton of fans from around the SEC. And I see that everywhere we go. Coming to Nashville next month for the SEC tournament, we'll get a lot of that. Fans come on, not just during the week that their team plays, and then they kind of tend to stay because the banter, the conversation is fun, and I think the content, it gets better and better. And we have SEC Mike on every Friday, so how could you not want to come on and join?
Absolutely.